Blog Talk Radio. This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth in Agony out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest dance choreographer and writer, L.A.'s own Rosanna Gamson. How are you, Rosanna?
I'm well. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Daughter of the renowned dancer choreographer Annabelle Gamson and opera conductor Arnold Gamson, Rosanna Gamson spent her childhood in both Rome and New York City. Gamson later studied dance composition with Hanya Holm and Bessie Schoenberg and earned BFA and MFA degrees in dance from NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. Gamson's creative process became more collaborative, and her dance vocabulary grew when she moved to L.A. in 1996. Her many dance theater projects have included live music, video projections, flamenco, tango, Chinese martial arts with text in German, Spanish, Mandarin, and Korean. You know, I could go on and on lauding your accomplishments, Rosanna, but I'd rather actually spend the rest of the time simply talking to you. You know, in some of the press materials for your latest work, Layla Means Night, there's a line that reads, "I am the weaver of endless stories." And this actually gets me to my first point. Through the years, you know, there have been many elements that have drawn me to your work. One of the most significant being your use of text and storytelling in your dance pieces. And I believe that while in college you had quite a strong poetry background, so perhaps this factors in quite heavily to your love of words and storytelling. Can you talk about your writing experience and how it's informed your dance performance work?
Sure. I was very lucky to fall into a group of poets in New York City when I first kind of ran away from home and ran to college at Sarah Lawrence College. And then I ran away from Sarah Lawrence College. And poetry was really exciting, and it was something that I had not, you know, it's a thing that everybody loves to do and hates to read in a way. It's sort of, you know, everybody's writing and nobody's reading. But this was actually a really exciting group of people who were super enthusiastic and excited about language. And I studied with Tom Lux at Sarah Lawrence. And then there was I can't remember the name. I think it was called the Writers, I can't remember the name of it. But Laurel Blossom ran it. And I got to study with Charles Simich and Louise Gluck. And they're, I think, great poets, like, you know, seriously, major serious contemporary poets, and people went to readings and it was fun, and they were way more glamorous and I may say more heterosexual than most of the dancers that I was hanging around with, so they were extremely appealing to me at that age to be in the sort of macho poetry boys clique. And it was a totally different way of inventing the world. And it was very, very exciting. I don't know. I hope they're all like still writing. But at that point in New York, it was a very, very exciting time for I think the next wave after the people who were the next wave after the people who were really inspired by Spanish Surrealism. So it was sort of like two or three generations later, people were coming back to trying to find an American voice. And actually, I think that's really interesting. So I think that whole idea about finding the language that is actually deeply rooted and also evolving right now is it's nice to be here. It's nice to be around it.
Yeah. So how did you get from that sort of experience to that light bulb going off and saying, okay, wait a minute, perhaps I can use this experience, my love of writing, to actually tell stories within these dance pieces I'm creating?
Well, I think people sort of, as you said, I didn't have a whole bunch of choice about dancing or being right. involved in dance. That's the world I grew up in, and that's kind of been the family business, and so that's the way it goes. But I think that I was very interested in making dances that people who are not already dancing would want to watch. That was the first thing. And a lot of people, it seemed to me, had trouble decoding or understand. They would find it attractive but somewhat incomprehensible what was going on with the dancing, unless right. they're looking at it extremely formally or compositionally or kind of on an intellectual level. So I thought the best thing to do was just tell people what I'm doing while I'm doing it and not be obscure. Just say, this is what I'm going to do. Now we're doing it. Okay, what we just did was this.
right.
And kind of like, okay, this is. I want you to think about this. And it also, this was not at the time, but it later came to me that we don't have that intimate second person in English. You know, we don't have the two form.
Right.
And that is exactly the voice I want to be in with the audience.
Yes.
And that yes. intimate, like the thou that we don't use anymore. And that kind of intimate you was really interesting. Like, that's how I wanted people to watch the dancing and experience the performance with empathy and to say, okay, we're doing the dancing that you're not doing. We're saying the things that you're thinking while you're watching it, so you don't have to work that hard to decode or go, oh, when they do that gesture to the downstage left, it means that something terrible is happening and they're yearning. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
It's like, so, I mean, I think that dance speaks for itself, but it added another layer, and I think it also added a different kind of music to it, and that's why I was also interested in having a lot of text that actually did have meaning in languages I don't speak. And that was really an outgrowth of being in LA. Sorry.
Well, that actually was a question that I wanted to ask to kind of follow this line of thought. In a number of performances that I've seen, you use a lot of, you know, different languages. You use like the alphabet either through, you know, whether it's within the story or dancers creating body shapes that mimic letters of the alphabet. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
Sure. Actually, this is something that is coming up a lot in the piece I'm currently working at. In Islamic art, there's a lot of use of text as an ornament, and calligraphy in Asia and in different parts of the world is a big art. You know, it's not it is decorative, but it's an important and it's an art, and it's also a sort of a spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the shape. The thing that's really cool, see how articulate I am? The thing that's really cool about language is that it's got meaning, and it has music, and it also is visually can be beautiful. And it's also like, you know, how people wear a word around their neck, or they wear their name, or like you wear a chai, the Jews wear the chai on your neck, which is a letter. It's also talismanic. It's also like magical. So, and I like the idea that it's working on all those different levels, that when you see a word, and we don't read letters now after you get to be, I don't know, past first grade or so, you don't read the letters, you right. read the words or the words all at a time. And that's why you say, oh, you misread sometimes the word you're expecting to see. And I like that idea that you see something and it has meaning, and you hear it in your head, and you also see it, and you also have associations. It's almost like smell, you know,
right.
That you have a whole bunch of associations with it.
Yeah.
You know, talking more about Layla Means Night, here's something that I believe you have said about this piece, and I'm going to quote you. The story of Scheherazade is about balancing on the knife's edge between keeping your listener entertained and transforming him through the power of your storytelling. With Layla Means Night, this transformation is achieved by engaging one-to-one, turning the spectator into an active participant, as the U.S. struggles with its relationship to Islam, to the Middle East, and to women. It feels important to authentically engage. My challenge in Layla is to make something subtle and melodramatic, complicated and accessible, attractive and repellent, that we go through together, that keeps you with me. I'm curious, which is beautiful, by the way, and having actually seen Layla, taken part in the experience, this is beautiful, and you nailed it. I'm curious, how do you go about taking such big ideas as, you know, the U.S. and our relationship to Islam, the Middle East, and women, and, you know, all these big ideas big meaningful ideas that you deal with, and distill them down into a dance performance piece? What is your process?
I think it's reliant on an extreme lack of funding, because it takes me a really long, long, long time to get it together, to make these sort of very ambitious pieces. So I sit with them for a long time. It takes me 2 or 3 years to go from, I want to make this piece, I want it to be like this, and that's just to the premiere, and then hopefully the piece will have a life after that. But I sit with it for a very long time, and I try really hard to get people whose point of view I don't understand to play with me in the collaborative sense of invest and engage their energy and time and ideas in the piece. So I think it's with Layla Means Night, it was a very, very long, it's been forever that I've been working on it, but it was important to me to have people who were believers, and I'm not a believer, and to have people who had strong, so it's not just me going and ripping off other people's cultures, you know
right.
what I mean? Like,
right.
like they have to kind of be in on the conversation. I think we are, let me just back up a second.
Yeah, please.
I think the thing I'm really, really interested in is intimacy and really being close for that moment. And I'm really, it's so interesting how it's so hard to sustain that, how you have the really deep contact and then everybody like jumps back, like almost like you get a shock.
Right.
And I think it's very curious how I keep approaching people and asking them to be very engaged with me, And I don't know them. It's not like these are based on personal relationships or like I don't know them before I go find them and say, oh, you are, I love your music and you're, have a really deep understanding of Sufism and I don't believe in anything spiritual and why do you? And like, so far nobody's been like, you strange woman, go away from me now. I'm waiting for that to happen, but, you know,
right.
Sort of like, hi, I'm a Jew. I'm here in Poland. Can we talk about the Holocaust?
Right.
So I keep waiting or, you know, how do you feel about, or like the Mexico Project. And for people who don't know who
that
would
have been
really,
for Aura?
Yeah, for Aura, it was, I saw a woman's choreography and I thought, oh, we're on the same page. And then, you know, it turned out we weren't at all, but there was something about her work I wanted to be in dialogue with or, so how do I get these big, huge ideas? I don't know. I like making projects that are too big for one imagination because
I
then
like
I
that.
Don't have to do it for my,
yeah.
by myself.
There's a Tombstone quote.
Too big for one imagination.
I like making stories too big for one imagination.
Yeah, so it's like I don't really get to these big ideas or these big productions by myself. And it, we literally, I think, we're trying with Layla to actually have a performer pretty much of some kind or another. Well, I think it's, it works out to be 2-1, 2 audience members to each performer. But we really want to, you know, we wash your hands. We try to make you eat too much and drink too much. We try to convince you of things that are maybe not so true and give you a really good time and try to take your money and, you know,
it's
manipulate
really quite,
you any
I mean,
kind of way we can.
Yes, yes, and it's really quite a spectacle. Actually, I wanted to talk about that for a moment. You know, I've attended some of the performances for Layla here in L.A., and just what you were talking about, I love how you get the audience involved with the production to the point where they are part of the production. And, you know, I've seen a number of your works over the years, and this is one of the first that really seemed to engage your audience and your performers on this whole new, and a word you used earlier, this, you know, this extremely intimate level. And I'm curious, how has this process been for you and your performers? And has this experience made you want to create more work in this vein?
Yes. I think it's been a long time coming and you said, okay, why do you have language in it? And
right.
it was a strategy so that people would connect to it easier and more, maybe perhaps in different ways and more deeply. And then with the last project, I put the audience on two sides and I made the performers talk to them directly. Not usually have a narrator and the narrator does all the talking, but in this piece, it was the performers were not only just talking from the stage, but really up in your face. And then this project, we wanted to make you be able to smell, taste, touch, you know, all of those things. So when you come in, we wash your hands. Well, actually, you have these kids, and the kids wash your hands, but not like, here's some soap, wash your hands. It's like they wash your hands for you in a
yeah.
very... like it feels really good.
Yeah.
And they rinse your hands and they dry. And there were people who came up after the show and said, nobody's washed my hands since I was a little kid.
Wow.
You know, like nobody's actually just said, here, I'm going to wash your hands for you. And it is that experience of not just washing your kids' hands when they're like dirty and they have to go eat dinner, but washing the way that you bathe babies or something. It's not, it's very intimate and it's not sexual.
Right.
And I think a lot of the things that we came across were trying to be intimate without being sexual or romantic.
Yeah.
And that's the first experience. And then people whisper in your ear and put something in your mouth and blindfold you and, you know, so it was trying to Somebody came to audition for me and it's like, oh, it's the haunted hayride. And I was like, yes, it's exactly the haunted hayride. That's right. And I think that fun houses and, certain kinds of carnival things, they've gotten this for a long time. So I don't think I'm inventing anything new. And, I think that people have a lot of interest in making really immersive theater. But another reason that I'm so interested in it is at a certain point in my life was like dying to have a bigger audience. I'm still kind of dying to have a bigger audience. But what if you don't get a bigger audience, so you need a more impact per capita,
Right, right.
So, yes, I'm very interested in doing more of this or figuring out how to, it's a little bit of an experiment and a little bit of a crapshoot. We're also have divided the men and the women from each other. So the men see one show and the women see a different show. So we're trying to run, and then we have a mixed group. So we're running three shows simultaneously.
Yeah.
And if we can do this, I would love to do it again. Or I would love to never do it again, depending on what happens.
Right, right. speaking of the whole experience with the hand washing and, the kids sort of blindfolding you and guiding you through the performance, when I was at the last performance I saw of Layla, as I was blindfolded and being led around by this young girl, I believe probably like middle school, high school age, she said to me, "Are you Mr. Ferguson?" And I was like, yeah. It turned out I was her teacher when she was like in fifth grade. And I was like, oh, my God, this just keeps getting more and more surreal, And then she proceeded to tell me this story about this Mexican trucker who was smuggling drugs in a dead dog. And I was like, okay, this girl is off onto a good foot. She's got, she's working with Rosanna. She's telling crazy, twisted, beautiful stories like this, and this girl will do okay. I don't have to worry about her.
Those girls were really great. They came from my daughters both go to different artsy schools, high schools, middle and high schools, and so those girls were so game and so fun to work with, and we were trying to get them to tell stories that would make the men change their faces, that we would get, while you were blindfolded, you were being watched.
Right.
I don't know if you know that, but you do now.
Yeah.
So it was a secret, but they're talking to you to sort of make you good to look at for the other people.
Oh, interesting.
Story. So they're trying to get you to be shocked or amused or sad or to like change your face as much and your body as much as they can. So
Wow. They
were coached to tell stories that would be pretty wacky.
She did a great job.
I think they
job.
Got better at it. Yeah, they were really good.
I believe you originally came up with the idea for Layla while you were still living in New York City. Can you talk a little about what originally inspired the piece and how it's changed since you brought it here to LA?
Yes. Originally, the idea came from the first truck bomb. There was a car bomb at the World Trade Towers, at the World Trade Center, before the planes. They tried previously, and there was a lot of anti-Arab sentiment in New York and people getting beat up who were or were not Arabs, but who might look like they possibly could be or something. And there was not a lot of restraint urged by the government the way it is now. Every time there's the government sort of comes in and says, hey, don't be stupid. But at that time, they didn't as much. And the idea of kind of demonizing other people that you don't really understand or know and saying it's those people's fault was very much in the air.
Right.
And that was what the first spark was. And then I went, because of that, I thought, well, I actually don't know anything about this. And there was a lot of conflict in the areas I specifically wanted to go to, but Morocco is a big tourist, you know, destination. So we went to Morocco, and I started making the piece in New York. And it honestly, Rich, it was like the first good thing I did. It was
wow.
a piece that I mean, it wasn't great, but it had a lot of good things in it that are, actually, there's a couple of things that are still in the piece, but I was pregnant at the time with my older daughter, and I looked at this piece, and usually my response to my own work is, oh, wait, the next one's going to be so much better than this. Like, now I know what to do. Okay, now I know what to do. And with this piece, I thought, oh, wow, this is something interesting. And it was the first time that I used storytelling. And
oh,
it was the first time that I used text to the extent that I had. I think it was the first time I used text. And it was the first time I used, the score was live, and there was a lot of vocal music in it, because I think I had only used text as lyrics, as like aria. But in this, there was actual talking, and I thought, oh, this is really good. And then I looked at it, like, you know, many years later, and I thought, oh, it's not that good. And I could really make this piece the way I want it to be. And so that's why I sort of started on it. And then I thought, well, there was a part in it where the king eats a roasted chicken. And the way we did it the first time is he had exactly 3 minutes to eat an entire roasted chicken. And he was a very funny guy with a blue, and he had a beard, and we dyed his beard blue, and he ate this roasted chicken. But there was something about having the smell of the roasted chicken in the theater, and there was this really place where you could get really good roasted chickens in New York at that moment, and the whole smell of the whole place was this chickeny smell. And I thought, oh, I should go that way. I should make things smell more, and I should make people have to taste things. And the experience of eating with your hands is, you know, that's what started the whole thing. It's like, because we washed his hands, and then we gave him the roasted chicken. I was like, well, everybody should be the king, because I'm really just trying to keep myself alive here.
Right.
You know? So that's how it started again. And also, you know, more to the point, it came up again because I do have two teenage daughters, and my older daughter is, you feel a different kind of responsibility. Like, well, okay, how am I complicit in raising, or not raising, but you know what I mean? Like, what am I doing to my daughters?
Right.
And what is the world doing to my daughters?
Yeah.
And what happens if abortion becomes illegal? And what if they don't think they're as good as if they were boys? And what if I'm complicit in it and think, oh, you're, you know, like, do you really need that other helping of whatever it is? You know what I mean? It's like, how am I doing here? And what am I doing? And I'm aging, and, you know, how am I, like, do I really want to look like I'm 16? This is what 16 really looks like. It looks pretty good, but, you know.
Yeah.
But
right.
I don't know that I will need to be there. Anyway, so those two things. And, you know, the recent, I would say in the last few years, the recent increasingly weird conservative movement that has kind of taken out a vendetta against reproductive rights is concerning.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, that's how I get these big ideas, okay?
Yeah. You know, it used to be that when I thought of dance, because I'm from the East Coast, North Carolina, New Jersey, I went to Rutgers University my last semester at college. I took a modern dance class just on a whim, loved it. The the professor, the teacher was encouraging me to study dance in New York, continue all that. So it used to be kind of a knee-jerk reaction. When I thought of dance, I thought of New York City as being the stronghold of dance performance. But when I first saw your work here in L.A. back in the 90s, mid-90s, I realized, wow, you know, creative, cutting-edge dance work is happening here in L.A. What inspired your move from New York to L.A., and how would you say your work has changed since the move?
Well, first of all, full disclosure, you were in one or more of the first
things I did
here. Yeah,
I've been in a few things, actually.
Yeah. So obviously your teacher had an eye. I think I got better. I think I got more skillful. So, you know, good for me. New York is extremely hierarchical, and also, as you said, as you first introduced me as my mother's daughter, I was like, I could feel my spine contracting. And I think here nobody really knows who my mother is, which is very liberating. So that's good. I moved here because nothing much was happening for me in New York, and I felt like I was banging my head against the wall. And my husband, Barnaby, said, if we just go to L.A., I can get a lot more work as an editor. And he'd been schlepping my stuff around and my props around for a long time, and he's like, okay, well, you know, give me 6 months, and let's see how you like it. So I moved here. I hated it with a passion. I did not know how to drive. I was really very New York, and I had to learn how to drive, and I had a kid, and I didn't know anybody. And so the people that I met who were interested in dance were not contemporary dancers. So it changed, and I was a big snob. And there was like high art, and there was much bigger division in my head about what high art and low art was and how cultures interacted. They basically didn't. There was a kind of, I don't know, like the holy concert stage of dance or something. I don't know exactly how to put it. But it was, you know, you didn't make dances about things. You made dances, and the dancers in New York are beautifully trained, and the dancers in Los Angeles are different because they're not neutral. I'm making really gross generalizations, and I hope you don't get like lots of screaming people, but I think that in New York, the difference is that the dancers reveal the choreography, and the choreography is what you're coming to see. And I think in L.A., maybe because people come into dance through other forms, or maybe because they work in the commercial dance world, or maybe because something to do with the water, who knows, they're not necessarily versatile, but they're very much themselves. And identity is such a huge question here. And so my job in a lot of ways changed so much from organizing the choreography or composing to trying to devise strategies to show you the dancers.
Right.
And to have you engage directly with the dancers and to kind of become more and more invisible so you feel connected to the performer rather than connected to my voice, which is not, you know, it's a little disingenuous because it's a very organized world that I'm making that has a lot of specific gravity and, you know, each piece is very much its own little world. But really, it's more fun when you're in it I guess I changed from like wanting to have the audience feel for the dancers rather than to watch them.
Right, right.
You know
when I was involved with your work and just having seen different performances as an audience member, I mean, especially when I was on the inside, there was almost like this three-ring circus feel at times. I mean, you'd get someone who was like a fluent in flamenco dance. You'd get someone else who was like a really good modern dancer. You'd get, someone like me who basically...
was an interesting person.
Yeah, an interesting person and did some spoken word performance. And you gather all these people from these different worlds and you sort of put them together and you make it work. I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Oy. I hope I make it work. I think it's, again, that thing about I'm actually a very, in many ways, very shy person, which it comes as a shock to anybody who knows me. But I have a lot of sort of social anxiety, but I don't have that kind of social anxiety one-to-one. I really am interested one-to-one. And so I hate doing auditions because I feel, A, I can't see anything. But it was more that, you know, when Johnny, too, was dancing with me, he's a beautiful dancer, very beautiful dancer, and I said, well, just come for dinner and we'll know in 5 minutes if we like each other or we hate each other, you know. And he did. He came to dinner and we hit it off and then we went in the studio and we worked around and then we worked together for 10 years or something.
Yeah.
But it's more, I think that you know a lot about somebody when they walk out on stage. You know so much about them and so much about who they've chosen to be. And I think that the common denominator between all those people is that they are really comfortable with the choices that they've made about who they're going to be.
Yeah.
And that, like, you, Rich, are not trying to be Joe or Tony. You're just you, and you've invented yourself, and this is who you chose to be.
Right.
And it's a long process. But I think everybody I work with has that security that they can retain identity within an ensemble and that they can they're not still discovering who they know already. And some people, like those little kids, they knew already they were 15, you know, and they know. And that was why they were willing to do it, because they had that thing. Another thing is that because it takes so long to develop a piece, and because we have to put up with each other for a long time, and people go through life changes, and people die, and people get, you know, married and whatever happens, but we have to. If you don't have that containment, then I think a lot of dance companies, and I think a lot of theater companies and other ensembles, they kind of implode or explode when people don't have that kind of integrity. So that's the common denominator. And then you get everybody like that in the room, and they're like, oh, we're all really attractive, and we don't look anything like each other.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
They're happy.
Yeah, exactly. No competition.
Right,
I mean,
exactly. It's like, I'm the Rich, I'm the Johnny, I'm the this one.
Right.
I don't have to be, I'm the Paul, I'm the,
right.
You know, whatever. And you only have to worry about being true to yourself. You don't have to try to be something else.
Yeah.
You're the authority.
Right. Well, speaking of Paul Outlaw, you know, that's another thing that I've really loved about your work over the years. There's, I don't know if I would call it a stable of performers, but there have definitely been certain performers that you've used in different pieces through the years. Paul Outlaw, he's often been your narrator for, mm-hmm. different productions. The two incredibly strong dancers, Alexandria Yall and Karen Nolan. You mentioned Johnny too before. Also Edgar Miramontes, who's been in some of your shows. I mean, you kind of already sort of answered the question, but just to go a little further about particular people like the ones I just mentioned, what were some of the aspects about those people that just sort of had you going back to them and saying, you know, I think I would like to use you in this production. Oh, and then in this production.
Well, I like them.
Yeah. They're like all they're incredibly
nice.
Yeah. Nice.
They're like all good people and they're funny and they're quick. And, you know, one of the criteria is, do you want to travel with people? Is always really important. Are they going to be a pain in the neck?
Yeah.
So there's that. But I think I think they are the people I imagine. I don't know. It's like you get to invent the world, and then you get to put the people in it who you think, oh, these people should be in my world. And then they all are very creative. So they're nice and they're creative and they're I know what it is. It's like, you know, when you're a kid and you play pretend game and you're like, okay, I'm Superman and you're Batman or whatever, and then I'm going to turn into a horse and then you're going to be the princess, right?
Right.
And the other kid goes, okay, I don't want to be the princess. I'm going to be a firefighter, right? And you're like, okay, so then the firefighter comes in, you know, whatever. And that adaptability, like, okay, great. And the thing about the performers that you mentioned or the people that I work with for a long time is they don't balk. They don't go. They never say no. You know, they're just like, okay, now I'm the firefighter.
Yeah.
All right. Now I'm the fairy princess.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're good to play with. They're like really good to play with. And,
yeah.
And I don't mean like play with like they're a doll, but play with like they're a playmate. And I think it's that we're in the same. We can get into the same pretend game without a lot of fuss and muss. We don't have to do warm-up exercises to make stuff up. We can just, all right, let's make stuff up.
Yep.
And then also, I mean, with Karen and with Alexandria, who are two physically, two ends of a very long, you know, physically not alike, I just want to point out, since you don't see what they look like, I think they both were competitive athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Karen was a competitive gymnast, and Lexi Alexandria was an All-American high jumper, and they have that. I can go a little further. I can do a little more. Thing.
Yeah.
They're super aggressive about moving and competitive in a good way, like competitive in that way that jocks are. Like, oh, I don't know if I can do. You know, so a lot of my choreography is like, oh, is it possible to do this and this? And they're like, I don't know, let me try. But they're brave. They're both.
Oh yeah.
They're very brave. And
I
think Paul is very brave. And
yes,
so
he
is Edgar. You know? They're like valiant in the best, you know, in that way. Like, so I guess they're my heroes.
Yeah. You mentioned early on in the show that form of writing or whatever, the you or whatever, and sort of being really intimate with the audience, you know, that's one thing I was really taken, you know, with Paul and still to this day just truly admire about him. He has this way of addressing an audience, whether it's through your work or his own solo work, where there is this really intimate bond, and it's really great to see him during your performances be sort of the voice of you, but really pull the audience in, and it really works.
Yeah, I mean, Paul has been me for a long time in my shows, you know, and I think he's him. He gets to be him on his shows, but you know, and he, and his work is really great, and everybody should go see it. He's very relaxed with himself.
Yes, he is.
You know, I think he's a really a very good example of somebody who's a very unique person, very doesn't fit into stereotypes of anything, and yet he certainly is not like going, oh, I'm, you know, he's a gay black man. He's of a certain age. He's not young. He's quite beautiful looking.
Yes,
and
he is.
And it's not what you expect. It's always like a little bit of a twist on it, you know? And he's also, I think he's just very relaxed on stage, and he doesn't act all acty.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's not like acting.
No, no.
He just sort of goes on and talks to people, and that, and you know, and that's also like, we grew up in the same culture, weirdly enough. We should have met many, many times before. His friends, we have friends in common, like from when we were 18, and he grew up in New York in the same sort of period I did, and he, in sort of apres-punk, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of common cultural bonds between us. But he's very much himself.
Yeah. You know, we're getting close to the end of our time,
okay,
but I want to ask you a couple more questions. You've collaborated with dancers from Mexico. You mentioned Poland earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel cross-cultural collaboration adds to your work?
Expensive. Much more expensive.
Right.
It adds a lot of time and trouble. You know, I think before I was very intrigued with this specific Mexican artist, and that was where that collaboration started with. I was very, very amazed when I saw the theater that was coming out of Poland, and I had never heard of Jerzy Grotowski, really, because I was really ignorant about it, and I was fascinated with the training that they were doing. And but as I've been wandering around, I realized how American I am, which was, believe me, so surprising. I think the other thing that's great about LA, or horrible about LA, or whatever about LA, is like, we're the export capital of American culture. We are putting it out there for the world, what America is. And it was really interesting to go to places where being an artist is like really well respected, and people like you, and you know what I mean? Like, your work is important, and you might have something to say that might be meaningful to somebody. That's a really great feeling. And as an American, I don't get that too much at home. So that's really nice to be in other places where, you know, they still all believe that art can change the world. So that's a very affirming, wonderful thing to be around. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably enough. I think I'm more specifically interested. Like, I'm hoping to go to Lithuania because I met this guy in Poland who was such a beautiful dancer, and so unusual that I was like, hey, we should probably work together. And so I'm trying to get to Lithuania now.
Nice, nice. Oh, you know, just another day for Rosanna Gansen.
there's nothing where he lives. Anyway, yeah.
So final thoughts on Layla Means Night. I believe you have a couple upcoming performances, one here in L.A. and San Francisco. Can you mention those briefly?
I would love to. We're having a show on Saturday, the 17th. August 17th, coming right up. We're taking over the Electric Lodge, and it's kind of a test of all of the material that we haven't done yet. So it's new material. If you've come to any of the other shows, it's all new.
Nice.
And I'm trying something new, and I can tell you about it, but not right now. And, August 17th, and there's a 7:30 and an 8:30 seating. So if you come to the 7:30, you get dinner, and you get your hands washed, and you get
nice.
Special treats, and you get much more of the interactive, you know, be in the show kind of experience. And
right.
then at 8:30, we're sort of doing something that's a little bit more presentational and testing out all the new, like the material that you can sort of see more conventionally. This is all in preparation for October 30th through November 3rd. We're going to be in San Francisco at ODC Theater, is presenting the premiere of Les Lamines Night. And it's we're doing 10 shows up there. I believe it's a 7 and a 9 every night. And we're taking over the whole building, the stairs, the studios, the theater, the seats, everything. They're turning us, they're giving us the whole building. It's amazing.
Nice.
And that is the extravaganza that we have been testing everything for.
Excellent. So what's the best way for people to find out about you online and to also be updated with what's going on with Layla?
Well, you could like my Facebook page. Isn't that stupid. Rosanna Gamson Worldwide. Rosanna Gamson Worldwide, and our web is our like whatever site thing, which we had nobody's updated in about 6 months because we've all been really, really, really busy, probably two
right.
years. But it's RosannaGamsonWorldwide.org, and I am incredibly easy to find and accessible if you just want to talk to me. I mean, like if you look up Rosanna Gamson, you'll get phone numbers and email addresses and everything you could possibly want. And we would love you to come.
Yes. Yeah, and the Electric Lodge is in Venice, by the way, if you've never been there, a great performance space, and that's going to be great. With me today has been Rosanna Gamson, choreographer, writer, one of LA's finest. Rosanna, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, Rich. This is really nice. It's nice to talk to you.
Yeah, I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Julia Callahan for helping to produce today's show. Also, a big thanks to Paul Outlaw and Edgar Miramontes for research assistance. Poeticscape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, and Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth and Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be Eels co-founder, drummer to the stars, and all-around great guy, Butch Norton. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poeticscape.